I've done a lot of work in this area because of this fact that the Earth's magnetic field strongly supports Scripture. The creationist theory explains the main features of the field, its origin, past reversals of the Earth's magnetic field, and past fluctuations, going up and down of the Earth's field strength, and the field's present decay. We'll talk about it now. The field is decreasing steadily and has been doing so for 1,000 years. The main result of all of this is that the Earth's magnetic field has to be less than 8,700 years old. That's pretty close to the biblical age of 6,000 years. And there's good reason, and we'll talk about them, to think that the true age is a few thousand years less than the 8,700 years, so that makes it very close to 6,000 years. Now, to understand how I got this number, will take a bit of patience on your part. The story turns out not to be as simple as creationists thought a few years ago, so some of you have learned a little bit about this subject, but have studied the older writings on this, will have to do some unlearning. But I've boiled the story down to the bare essentials, and I've divided the story up into bite-sized sections. So every time you see a green section marker like this, that's a new section. And this is the introduction section. And the first, I'm going to discuss these three questions. What causes, or what is the Earth's magnetic field? What causes it? What keeps it going? This is just background information that everybody who studies the subject would agree upon, whether evolutionist or creationist. First question is this one. What is the Earth's magnetic field? And I have a simple answer right there. It's what makes compass needles turn north. I mean, that's pretty simple. So the Earth's magnetic field is an invisible force that works on iron objects. You measure the strength of the field at a particular point by measuring the force on something like a compass needle at that point. It tends to twist the compass needle, and you can measure the force with which it twists the compass needle. And the stronger the field, the stronger it's going to twist the needle. So that's how you measure the strength of the field. And remember, strength. I'm also going to talk about energy of the Earth field. That's something different. We'll explain that. But the strength is just how much force you have on a compass needle. Now, the field is not related to gravity. I have had to explain that to some technicians at Sandia National Labs. I was surprised. They associated the magnetic field with gravity. They didn't think it through too clearly. So if we turned off the Earth's magnetic field, we wouldn't suddenly fly out into space. And it's not related to the Earth's rotation either. Now, you'll notice here, I've drawn magnetic lines of force, these dotted lines. Every point on that line shows the direction a compass needle would point. So you can trace out lines of force simply by following a compass needle through space, if you could do that. And you notice how they enter the Earth here, not at the Earth's geographic pole, but a little to the side. And similarly down here. And you've probably noticed on your maps that the Earth's magnetic poles do not line up with the Earth's geographic poles. So, and in fact, the magnetic field is tilted by about 11.5 degrees. So that suggests that maybe the magnetic field is not related to the Earth's spin, and that's a good suggestion. There's magnetic fields on other planets, too, in the solar system that have been measured. And some of those planets do not rotate at all to speak of, and yet they have a magnetic field. So, and on other planets, the magnetic poles are down near the equator on two other planets in the solar system. Remarkable finding that was found out recently. So it doesn't really have anything to do with the planet's rotation. Now, the Earth's field would stop this instant, we probably wouldn't notice anything. We wouldn't fly out into space. The cosmic rays that we now get would not increase very much, only by about 10%. And the sun would still rise in the east. We'd still rotate. So, notice again how these lines of force go into the interior of the Earth here, and they appear to come out of the interior of the Earth here. That suggests that whatever causes the Earth's magnetic field is in the interior of the Earth, and that brings up our second question. What is it that causes the Earth's magnetic field? And the simple answer is an electric current in the Earth's core. Now the Earth's core, this thing in yellow here, this whole thing is the Earth. This thing in yellow is the Earth's core, and it's a dense electrically conducting fluid that's 3,000 kilometers beneath our feet, about halfway down into the Earth. And we know that information from seismic waves traveling through the Earth. We can tell that it's a fluid, and there's other information that tells us it's an electrically conducting fluid. So, the Earth's core is a giant electromagnet. It's got an electric current, and the source of the Earth field, that is an electric current there, and it turns out to be about 6 billion amperes circulating. And the electrons in this current are moving from west to east like this. And so that's the way I've drawn the arrow, but there are also positive charges in the current that flow the other way from east to west. So again, don't associate that current flow with the spin of the Earth's field. In planets that don't spin, they still have an electric current. So both evolutionists and creationists agree on all these things that I've said, and on this answer to our second question. However, evolutionists and creationists differ sharply on the next question. And that is, what is it that keeps the currents going? And now, the evolutionists say a, quote, dynamo, unquote, in the core, an electric generator in the core. Do you call them dynamos here or generators? Either, okay. Now, the creationists suggest that nothing keeps the current going but its own electromagnetic inertia. And as a consequence, the current is decreasing in the core. And we call that a free decay. The current is decaying freely. And I'll explain both of these things in a moment. And these two theories have not been equally successful. Let's look at the evolutionist theory first. The evolutionary dynamo theories haven't worked. The first one was proposed by an English scientist named Bullard in 1949, and he suggested that flows of fluid in the Earth's core act like an electric generator. And he basically proposed that heat energy in the core moves these flows of fluid, and that the flows of fluid interacted with the magnetic field that then existed in a complicated way to keep the electric current going. And the basic process is very similar to the motion in an electric generator that keeps the electric current flowing, say, in a loop of wire, something like that. Now, as we'll see in the next view graph, the electric current can't keep itself going in the core for more than a few thousand years. And the problem that evolutionists faced and that Bullard was trying to solve was how to keep this current going for billions of years, because they think the Earth has been around for billions of years. And so Bullard made the suggestion of the electric dynamo or the electric generator, but his theory has had problems. And it's not just his theory, but all the theories that have sprung from that first idea and have the same basic principle. The first problem is that the theories are very complex. The very first simple versions of the theory didn't work. And pretty soon after that, evolutionary theorists eliminated all the simple possibilities. And the theories gradually became more and more complex. And the flows and currents, the electric currents and the flows in the core that they conjectured, became as complicated as the wiring in an electric generator. Or perhaps you've seen how the wiring looks in an electric motor. It's very complicated, and the current flows that the evolutionists talk about have to be that complicated. Now, the problem is that the core is just one big spherical conductor, and it doesn't have the nice handy wires with insulation around them to force the current where you want it to go. said the current goes where it wants to go. And that is a big problem for these theories. So the theories have gradually gotten more and more complicated, and yet they're not complete at this point. The theorists can sort of say, well, if we can get this kind of very complicated flow of field in the core, then we think that we can get the current to flow in the way that we want it to flow and get the magnetic field that we want. But they can't really say whether or not the Earth's core really would have these complicated flows of the fluid that are needed. And so the theory is incomplete. And yet very many intelligent men have worked on it for over 50 years, I guess, 40 years at least. So it's not finished. That's the second point. Now, you don't gather that impression from reading the high school textbooks or even the undergraduate college books. You kind of get the impression that the problem is solved, but when you actually talk to the experts or read their books and their articles, you find out that it's still very much an unsolved problem. So it's not a complete theory. Now, the third problem is that there's some recent data that has been found that does away with the most popular class of theories, or at least it weighs very heavily against those popular theories. I won't go into that data, but there are the most loved versions of the theory are now in serious trouble because of this new data. And the fourth problem is that the theories can't make specific numerical predictions. They're not in good enough shape to predict hard numbers about how strong the fields should be on the different planets. So they can just make sort of very general predictions, like this planet doesn't have any spin, you know, a particular planet like Mercury doesn't have much spin, so it shouldn't have much magnetic field because their theories depend on spin. Or this planet doesn't have a very large fluid core, and so it can't work. And the problem is that some of those predictions have been totally wrong, as the Voyager and other space probes have shown, and they were totally wrong for the planet Mercury, for Mars, for the Moon. The Moon used to have a strong magnetic field and doesn't have one now, and the planet Uranus. They were just totally wrong on those points, and so it made wrong predictions. Now let's consider a creationist theory. Now, these creationist pre-decay theories successfully explain much data. And the first one was proposed by Dr. Thomas Barnes, whom I count as my friend, and he's down at the University of Texas at El Paso. He's a retired physics professor there now. But he proposed in the 1970s that an electromagnetic flywheel in the Earth's core runs down slowly, that the electron flow in the core was like a gigantic flywheel, and that the magnetic field that goes along with the electron flow sort of makes the electrons have some inertia, so to speak, and they tend to keep running, but that the electrical resistance in the core gradually slows down this flow of electrons, just like a flywheel, a spinning flywheel would be slowed down by friction. It's an analogy here. I'm not saying that there's a mechanical motion in the core. What I'm really saying is that the electrons in the core are moving like that, not the whole core. But it's a very analogous effect. There's some inertia involved. And the bigger the core, the longer it takes to run down. And Dr. Barnes' theory is mathematically simple and precise and well-founded in basic physics. And his theory predicts the half-life of the field, just as radioactive decay has a half-life associated with it, so the decay of the magnetic field has a half-life. There's a certain length of time it takes, or would take, for the field to decrease to half its strength. And that half-life here, this is the only equation you're going to see today, and it's just sort of an approximate equation. That half-life depends on the radius of the current flow in the core, so that's about 2,000 kilometers in the core, that radius squared divided by the electrical resistance that's encountered there. And we know the size of the core very well, so we can get the top part of that term. We can only estimate the electrical resistance of the core from guesses as to what materials are in it, what the conditions are. But from those estimates, we can say that the half-life should be between 1,000 and 10,000 years. Now, it turns out that the field actually is decaying, and we'll talk more about that later. And it's decaying at such a rate that the half-life would be 1,400 years. So that's between the 1,000 and 10,000 that would be predicted by the theory. So that's a very good part of the theory. It predicts a decay that's about the same as the decay that we're seeing. So that's success. However, this early theory that Thomas Barnes proposed didn't explain a few things. It doesn't explain the origin of fields. How did the field get started? And people used to always ask that. Well, how did this electric current get started in the core in the first place? And it didn't explain the past reversals and fluctuations of the field. There's a lot of evidence that the field has reversed itself in the past, particularly when the fossil layers were being laid down. And there's evidence of past fluctuations, that is, field strength going up and down at a given point on the Earth's surface. The field changed its strength, and it went both up and down in strength. Now, Thomas Barnes' theory would not explain that. It would predict just a simple steady decay. Are the skies decaying here? Is that why we're getting so much rain here? So it doesn't explain these things. And so I added to that theory. I didn't really change its basic principles, but I added to the free decay theory in the 1980s and published a lot of things about that. So I'll outline those changes this morning. But first let's talk about how the field got started. So here's the next section, the origin of the field. What is it that started the electric current? To understand that, we have to understand how God created the field, in other words. And to do that, we have to understand what he says about the original material that he made. Now, prepare yourself for a biblical shock. There's some areas you may not have thought about here in the Bible. And the original material that God created was this stuff that's falling on our roof right now. Water. Now, how do I get that? Actually, this is a hypothesis. I won't say that the verses are ironclad, but this hypothesis leads to some very interesting and intriguing results about the Earth's magnetic field. But you'll notice back there in Genesis 1, you remember darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving on the face of the waters. So there's a suggestion right there at the beginning that there's water and that it's deep, that there's a lot of it. Now, in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 5, and I've quoted the New American Standard version of it because it's fairly faithful to the Greek at that particular point, it says that the earth was formed out of water and by water, or by means of water. So water was very important in the formation of the earth. Now, there was a lot of water there present at creation. But surely the earth wasn't originally water, was it? Well, that's what the Apostle Peter seems to be saying at face value. It was formed out of water and by means of water. Remember, Steve Austin said that I'm the most literal creationist in the world. Literal is not really how I take scriptures. I try to take them at face value. So if there's an obvious metaphor, like the trees clapping their hands and I can't find any hands for the trees, I will reluctantly admit that that's a metaphor. So the way I interpret it is not literally, but straightforwardly. There's something in Proverbs about God's wisdom being plain or straightforward. So anyhow, if God did start the earth up as a ball of water, as this verse suggested, then he would have to then transform the water, the nuclei of the oxygen atom and the nuclei of the hydrogen atom would have to be taken apart and put together in new ways. For example, if you wanted to make a sulfur atom, you'd take two of the oxygen nuclei out of the water molecules and take them and put them together and squeeze them together, and then you'd have, instead of oxygen 16, you'd have sulfur 32, and you'd rearrange the electrons and grab the right number of electrons to make the whole atom. And then if you wanted to combine the sulfur into a mineral, you'd grab some other atoms and you'd put them together. And this putting together is suggested by the Greek verb that's used there. The Greek is soon isthemai. That's the root of the Greek word that's used. And the word soon, or S-Y-N, as it's sometimes translated, like in symphony, together sound, means together. Soon means together. And isthemai means to put or place or stand. And the first meaning is put, second is place, and the third is stand. So the most literal meaning of the Greek verb is to put or place something together. And it's the same verb that I alluded to last night that talks about Christ holding in him all things consist or are held together. So the holding together is the same verb. So this implies a putting together of nuclei, atoms, and molecules. And I think that's remarkable. Now, some people will say, well, Peter couldn't understand nuclear physics and all the physics that was involved. That is true. But it doesn't mean that Peter didn't understand this verb. It means that Peter said that somehow the water was compacted or put together to make the other materials. He knew that he wasn't standing on water. He knew he was standing on rock and sand and dirt when he wrote that. And so I think Peter understood the basic process. He just didn't understand all the details. So, but God understood the basic process, and now that we've been filled in on some of the details about Adam, we can understand that process better. So that's the way we understand Scripture anyhow. We're always understanding it better as we add to our knowledge. So basically, I'm suggesting then that God made the earth as a ball of pure water, and then he quickly transformed that water into the other materials that the earth is now made of, and did all of that during creation week. And he made the water itself. He created the water. He didn't start with water. But when it says he created the heavens and the earth, that original earth he created was the water itself. That's a hypothesis. This may look like a pulpit, but I'm not making pulpit pronouncements. You know, I'm not saying, thus saith. You know, this is a scientific hypothesis, and it's something to be explored. And it was something that I, you know, wasn't too sure about. But I said, okay, this is an interesting idea. What would that amount to scientifically? Now, some people ask, why would God make the earth and other things out of water to begin with and then transform them? And I suggest that you do the research on that. Take out your concordance and look through Scripture and find out what Scripture uses water as a picture of. And then go back and see if God is saying something about us and about spiritual things in the way that he chose to make the universe. It's an interesting Bible study, and I'll talk with you more about that later, but it's not really a scientific question. But you may be wondering, what does the water have to do with magnetic fields? Well, it turns out that a water molecule can produce a tiny magnetic field. And it's tiny in respect to the magnetic field that you usually get from iron atoms. Magnetic fields from iron atoms are produced by the electrons, and the electrons have a fairly strong magnetic field for their size. But and that's because electrons are spinning little balls of charge that spin pretty fast. But there are other spinning balls of charge, namely the hydrogen nuclei in the hydrogen atoms. They're spinning balls of positive charge. They're a single proton. And a spinning electric charge makes a magnetic field, and this field has been measured in the laboratory and is well known, and it's about 1/1800th of the field of an electron. So it's a small magnetic field. But nonetheless, each of these hydrogen nuclei in the water molecule that you see here has a magnetic field. So this is a big oxygen atom. Here's its nucleus. And then here are two smaller hydrogen atoms. And this is about the scale, by the way, and they're off at an angle like that. And inside there are the protons that have the magnetic field. Now, it happens that the oxygen nucleus does not have an overall magnetic field because all of the protons in it are arranged in pairs that point in opposite directions, so they pretty well cancel out their magnetic fields. And similarly, for all the electrons in the whole molecule, they're lined up in pairs, and so they don't have a magnetic field. So it's just the protons that have a magnetic field. And normally, those protons throughout a body of water point in every which direction. They don't all point in one direction. So those fields all cancel one another out too, and so you don't think of water as being a magnetic substance. So, but I asked myself the question, what if when God made this big ball of water that was the earth, that when he made the water molecules, what if he made all those protons lined up in the same direction, all spinning in the same direction, so that their spin axes, say, pointed north? Well, then it turns out that the magnetic fields of all of these protons adds up. And it would add up to a large magnetic field. Now, would that field be large enough to explain the Earth's magnetic field, was my next question. And the answer is, there were enough water molecules to make the Earth's magnetic field. Now, this ball of water would have the same mass, same total quantity of matter as the Earth today, approximately, within a fraction of a percent. And so you can figure how many water molecules there were by taking the total mass of the Earth and divide it by the mass of a single water molecule. And the answer you get is 2 times 10 to the 50th power molecules. Now, that means 2 with 50 zeros after it. That's a lot of molecules. Pardon? Oh, I'm sorry. I don't even regard that. Yes, that's it. This is numbers here. I just lost my microphone here. Sorry about that. I suppose that is an equation. Yes, there's an equals mark and there's an equals mark. So 2 with 50 zeros after it. A lot of molecules, and you might suspect that because a molecule is smaller than you can see, and the Earth is a great big thing, so that much water would be a lot of molecules. And, okay, now we take that many molecules and we multiply it times the magnetic field of a single molecule, and that's something easy to work out in physics, if you're a physicist, and the answer you get is 72 times the Earth's magnetic field today. So certainly we can get enough magnetic field, more than enough. So the result is a field 72 times stronger than today's field. So now we have a magnetic field in the instant of creation, if God did it this way, produced by a great number of lined up molecules, or the protons in the molecules are all lined up. But remember, what's producing a field today is not lined up protons, it's an electric current. So how do we get an electric current from the lined up molecules? Well, if you're a physicist, that's not hard. But you would have to do a little bit of studying of the laws of physics. The ordinary laws of physics, if God allowed them to run at that point, the banging together of the molecules would knock the protons askew, and they would soon be pointing every which way, just like they do now in water. And so you would think the magnetic field would go away, but there's a law of physics that says magnetic fields, basically it says this, that magnetic fields like to preserve themselves, and if there's an electric conductor nearby, then there would start up an electric current in that conductor that could maintain the magnetic field. So as each little molecule disoriented itself, current would start up in this electric conductor. Now, was there an electric conductor present? The answer is yes. You may think of pure water as a good insulator, and it is at regular pressures and temperatures. But down in deep in a large body of water the size of the Earth, the normal way to make that would be to allow high temperatures to develop in the center. And under high temperatures and high pressures, water is a rather good electrical conductor. It's not a super-duper electrical conductor, not as good as some metals, but it's certainly a rather good one. And so over two-thirds of the interior of this ball of water would be a very good electrical conductor. So we've got our electrical conductor. So as each one of these molecules gets knocked askew, the magnetic field tries to decrease a little bit, but as it tries to decrease, that the word that's used in physics, that induces a little more current flowing in the electric conductor. It's an induced electric current, if some of you are familiar with that. Mr. Lenz's law, that's right. L-E-N-Z, German name, Lenz. And Lenz's law says basically, tells you what direction an electric field wants to be as it's trying to maintain itself, and tells you that the field likes to maintain itself. But it's a direct result of basic fundamental equations about the electromagnetic field. So you can look that up in textbooks if you like. So here we have the initial Earth, and the field is coming from oriented protons and molecules. And here, after a matter of just a few seconds, if God let it happen naturally, you would have the alignment of the protons going away, but instead you would have an electric current, and the magnetic field would be just a fraction of a percent less strong than it was before, but it would still be there. So you would have basically the field maintaining itself now by this electric current. So now we've got this large electric current, and that current would be about 400 billion amperes. So that's enough to preserve the magnetic field at nearly its original strength. So we've got an electric current. What would happen to that current then if God let physics take its normal course on that particular thing? Well, the current began decaying. Now, this may not have happened until the fall. Maybe God didn't permit this, but this is not really quite the same thing. It's not quite as bad as decay of human bodies. It's just a decrease. Current, you could think of it, the current began decreasing. So it's a matter of semantics whether that kind of decay is included in the decay that came into the world at the fall. But maybe this decay started at the fall then. I don't know. But here is time, and here is 6,000 years of time, and here is the strength of the Earth's field. Remember, the strength is what pulls the magnetic compass needles north, and the strength is the force that pulls it. And the strength at the Earth's surface would be, according to this theory, 72 times today's value. Now, I've mentioned several times that the Earth's field is decaying, and that right now it has a half-life of 1,400 years. So if we use that rate of decay and came down from 72 times today's value over 6,000 years, we'd wind up with a number that was four times today's value. Now, in physics, wild hypotheses like this are usually very wrong, meaning that you get answers that are millions of times wrong, or else they come close, and then you know you're on to something. And when I did this calculation, I said, wow, we're on to something here. This is close. I mean, this is a very crude calculation so far. I haven't taken account of a lot of things. So the point I'm making is that 72 times today's value combined with 6,000 years in today's decay rate gives us some interesting answers. However, we'll see that the story is not as simple, that it wasn't a steady decay, and that's where I depart from Dr. Thomas Barnes' theory. He just basically took today's value and extrapolated it back and got a number similar to this, and basically said, you know, if you went back much further than that, you would run into too high electric currents in the core and things like that. So he was right, but he didn't cover all of the details that we need to cover. So, but this decay would be what one would expect if nothing else happens in the core. So the numbers are generally reasonable for our planet Earth, but other planets in the solar system, if you remember, also have magnetic fields. So I thought of then applying this theory of origins of the field to the other planets in the solar system, because that was another way to check the theory. So how does that work? If God used the same process to create other planets besides the Earth, how would the magnetic fields in the rest of the solar system compare? So what's the performance of this theory in the solar system? Well, it turns out that this theory also works well for the sun, moon, and other planets, works well in the solar system. So I made a little scorecard here. And on one side is creation, the creationist theory, the free decay theory. The other side is the evolutionist set of theories, the dynamo theories. And here's the various bodies in the solar system: Sun, Moon, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. And a check mark means that the theory in question made a numerical prediction, which was either verified already or would be verified in the future. And a minus or a dash means, well, the theory didn't make a specific numerical prediction, but it wasn't disproved by the data. And then an X means it didn't make a specific numerical prediction, but it did make a specific enough prediction that was disproved. And so you see all these check marks for Sun, Moon, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. And when my theory came out in 1984, it's in the December 1988 Creation Research Society Quarterly, called the Creation of the Earth's Creation of Planetary Magnetic Fields. You can order that from CSF. They have a copy, and they can print out copies for you. When that theory came out in 1984, all of the planets down up through Saturn had been visited by space probes, and the magnetic field of the planets had been measured. But the planets Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto had not been visited by any space probe at that time. So I said, okay, this is a hypothesis that I have, and it looks pretty good for the planets that we have already seen. So if my theory is correct, then we should see thus and such field strength for the planets Uranus and Neptune. And I didn't do it for Pluto because we don't know enough about Pluto to make a prediction. You have to know the planet's mass, and there are only very wild guesses at that. And you have to know the size of the planet's core, or at least make a good guess at that. And we know nothing about Pluto. So I couldn't make a prediction about that. But there was enough data in the astronomical literature about those two planets to make a relatively good prediction. Now, they don't know how big the cores of those planets are or what's in them, but they can make some rough guesses, very approximate guesses about the cores of those two planets. So I had to put boundaries on my prediction. And what I said was it would be within these bounds. But I did have an actual number that I started from, and then I said, I better qualify that. We don't know the cores too well, so I put boundaries around it. And then in 1986, 2 years later, Voyager flew by Uranus and measured its field. And the other thing you need to know is that the evolutionists had some predictions about the planet Uranus. And basically, most of those evolutionists, and maybe all of them, I haven't done a total survey, said that the field of Uranus should be very small. Their number was 100,000 times smaller than the number that I had. So it was a good test. Two different predictions. And the reason they predicted a low field is because Uranus has very little measured heat outflow, and their theories depend on the flow of heat. You remember it's heat that's supposed to drive the dynamo. And they didn't measure much heat outflow from Uranus, so they said, okay, not much field. And so it's a good test. And lo and behold, Voyager flew by Uranus, and I'm proud and happy and overjoyed to report that, yay, Andrew says, that it fell right on my, it was very close to my original number, and it was smack in the middle of the bounds that I had set in this 1984 article. So, then later on came Neptune, and that came in 1989. Now, by that time, the evolutionist theories had wised up a little bit. They said, well, Uranus and Neptune are similar planets. They're about the same size. They spin at the same rate. And so even though we didn't see heat outflow from Uranus, we do see some from Neptune. So our guess is thus and such number. And it happened that the number was about the same as what they'd already seen in at Uranus. They already had a good... Basically, they were taking Uranus as their peg point, as the way to estimate the field. And that number that they then predicted was about the same as my number. And Voyager flew by, and Neptune turned out to have the field that my theory and their theory predicted. But again, their theory is sort of a hand-waving theory, and it was based on saying Neptune is like Uranus. But we'll give them some credit for Neptune. You know, they didn't have a specific number that was well-founded, but it didn't disprove their theory. And maybe I should even be less biased and give them a check mark there. I don't know. So you could say in those two planets, it's creationist 2 and evolutionist 1. Minus means that they don't really have a well-founded numerical result from their figure, from their theory that would either stand or fall. In other words, their theory is not falsifiable in that sense. It doesn't predict hard numbers. So it's sort of like a jellyfish. It's hard to disprove. You know, you can't punching a jellyfish is sort of time wasting. So, but that's a good theory is falsifiable. In other words, it's sturdy enough and makes definite enough predictions that have the possibility of being disproved. There's a guy named Karl Popper, some of you know about, who's a philosopher of science, that says basically that some theories are not very good because they're not falsifiable, and I believe that he included evolution in that class. In other words, evolution is a plastic enough theory that you can always stretch it out to meet the new facts. But the theory that I had was not plastic. It was either going to stand or fall on things like this. So that's why I give myself a check mark. I may be biased there. Is it fair and right to say that the creationist theory is a fair dinkum theory? Is that, okay, that's the right use of a word? Okay. So it's been 100% successful in the test. So... this theory is listed, the references, the technical references, I list in in the references for item 6 in that brochure, or that little pamphlet that's back there that's free. So you can look, if you want those references, you just specify them to CSF and ask them to send you a copy, and they will provide the copies that appeared in various journals. So now let's move on to two other things that needed explaining. We're lagging a little behind here. This is the third section, reversals and fluctuations of the Earth's magnetic field. And I'll just briefly touch on the results of this theory that I presented at the 1986 International Conference on Creationism. And I just gave a model there. And then in 1990, I gave a full theory, a full theoretical explanation. And item 6 also lists the references for that. So let's think about what happened to the Earth's magnetic field first during the Genesis flood and then after the flood. But first, what happened to it during the flood? Now, a disturbance in the Earth's core, my theory suggests, caused rapid reversals during the Genesis flood. Now, basically, my theory says that if you had something that either released heat in the core or cooled the surface of it, or both, you would get strong flows of convection. Hot fluid would rise, cool off at the top, and sink down. That's a normal physical process. When you heat a saucepan on a stove, or oatmeal, you watch the oatmeal rise and it comes up and then it goes back down another way. That's called convection. But if this happens at a certain strength, at a certain flow rate, then my theory shows that this would reverse the direction of the Earth's magnetic field. And this is not the time or the place to go into how that would do that, but that's described in my two technical articles, and I'll be happy to talk about it afterwards. But the result is that you'd get this kind of time behavior of the field during the Genesis flood. You would get the strength of the field increasing to a maximum and then decreasing and then reversing direction. The field would reverse direction. At that point, if you had a compass needle, you would see the compass needle swing from north to south. Nothing else disastrous would happen. The Earth would not flip over on its poles or anything like that. Just a change of the electric current direction in the core. And these reversals are recorded in the fossil layers. When rocks form, they lock in information about the Earth's magnetic field in them. And the study of that is called paleomagnetism, old magnetism. And there's heaps and heaps of evidence that this actually happened when those fossil layers were being laid down. At least 50 to 100 reversals happened while the geologic strata were being laid down. Now, we creationists have, and I've given you some, evidence that all of these fossil layers got laid down very rapidly. And there's lots and lots of evidence for that. And our basic hypothesis says that it happened during Noah's flood. So that means that these 50 to 100 reversals happened over the space of roughly a year, and maybe more happens after that. So, but 50 reversals in a year would be about one per week. So these reversals would happen about one per week. Now that's a radically different proposition than the evolutionary view, which says that, used to say that the field could not reverse itself faster than a few thousand years, and that generally it took a few hundred thousand years or even a few million years to reverse itself. Because you see, they're taking these hundred or so reversals and spreading them out over what they think the duration of the fossil column was, 500 million years. So that's where they get that number. And they had been conceiving these reversals as being majestic, ponderous, slow things. And here I'm saying they're very fast, sprints. So now in my 1986 paper, when I pointed all this out, I said there would be something that would be good evidence for this view, and that would be to find a lava flow which was very thin and would cool down in a matter of 1 or 2 weeks. And if that lava flow had locked in a substantial part of a reversal, that would be strong evidence for my theory. And that's written in my 1986 paper in the conclusion section. And has such evidence been found? The answer is yes. Evidence for rapid reversals, direct evidence, has been found. Now, this is a paper from Earth and Planetary Science Letters, April 1969, by a guy named Robert S. Coe and Michel Prévost. They're both big wheels in the field of paleomagnetism. They are well known in their field. And they went to a mountain that they had studied before, and this shows a plot of one of their data plots. This is the height of some lava flows. They called this point zero, and then there was a particular flow that was 190 centimeters thick, and then another flow above that, and there was one below that. Now, earlier in a paper that I had referenced in my paper of theirs, a paper that they had done, they had measured the direction of the Earth's field in this flow and in this flow here. And the two directions were 90 degrees apart. So let's say one direction was that way, and above it, another direction was that way. And they hadn't looked at this thin layer, but for some reason they went back in 87 or 88 and looked at that intervening layer, because they were interested in how the field changed. And they looked and they found a steady transition through that layer, and then they calculated how long it would take that layer to cool down with standard physics, and they got a very conservative figure, they say, of 15 days. Actually, it probably cooled down within a matter of a week. But they were being very conservative, as they should be. And so what they found was, if you notice the direction of my hands, the layer below pointed that way, and the layer above pointed that way, and in between, they found, as they rose through that layer, a steady progression of change of direction. So the field changed 90 degrees in the time it took that layer to cool down, which they said, even this very conservative figure of 15 days corresponds to an astonishingly rapid rate of variation of the geomagnetic field of 3 degrees per day. Now, I don't know, I think they were being doubly conservative there, because I take 90 degrees and divide it by 15 days and I get 6 degrees per day. So they threw in another factor of 2. They were really worried about saying this. And the whole paper is full of things like, truly strains the imagination and astonishingly rapid, and there's some really interesting quotes there. But they're honest, and they did the paper well. And there's been one commentary on the literature in it, and that's very cautiously approving. But this shocked the paleomagnetic world, and Robert Coe, I don't think he's a creationist. I didn't talk to him about this on the phone, but I asked him how people had reacted, and he said basically they don't want to believe it. But Coe has done it again. Just last year, he reported at another scientific conference that he had found another flow which was twice as fast as this one, and in a different location, at a different level. Now, the probability of finding a second one, if it truly is a million years between reversals, the probability should be extremely low. He should not have found the second one. So they're even more shocked at that second finding, and there's a brief report about it in Science, Volume 255, the 3rd of January, 1992, page 31, and I have a copy of it. And the title is A Conundrum at Steens Mountain, which is where this is, and it describes the problems that paleomagnetists and theorists are now facing. But I wasn't facing any problem at all. I was overjoyed about this. So, but to find this evidence throws the whole timescale of the geologic column into serious doubt. It shortens the timescale enormously. And there's other evidence for rapid reversals also, but not as direct. But I have been seeing that evidence for some years, and that's reported on in some of my papers. So it looks like we have a good theory for reversals. But what would happen to the field after the flood? Well, this disturbance I spoke of, remember, that produced the reversals, would also chop the electric current into smaller loops of current. It wouldn't be one big loop of current. Not just that, but there would be a lot of other loops of current just due to all the roiling and boiling in the core. That would force the current to have many sort of little eddies and whirls like that. And those eddies of current would be pointing in every which direction. So it would leave the field after the flood in a real mess. It would be very complicated. But you remember that the size of the loop of current determines how fast it decays. The smaller the loop, the faster it decays. So the smallest loops of current would rapidly decay away in a matter of years. And some of the larger loops would decay away over hundreds of years. The very largest, second largest loop would decay over several thousand years. And the largest loop is the one we have left. So after the field, these small loops, after the flood, these small loops decayed. And that would make the field strength fluctuate up and down. Now notice I said the field strength. The field's energy would be a different matter. The field's strength went down and up, but its energy always decreased. And here's the strength versus time at a certain point on the Earth's surface, and it would bounce up and down. But the fluctuations would be up and then down like that. However, if you plot the total energy of the field, and you do that by measuring the strength everywhere and doing a certain mathematical formula, or there are other ways to get it, but the total energy is stored everywhere in the field, that total energy would decrease. And why would it decrease while the field at the surface is going up? The answer is the field in the core is going down at that moment, and it's going down faster than the field at the surface. And this works out from the mathematics. So basically, the energy is pretty simple. It's always decreasing, even during these reversals and fluctuations. So that's what happened during the flood and for a few thousand years afterwards. And then what happens later? That brings us to this part, the decay of the field. There's the present rapid decay, and then from that we can get the age of the field. So here's what the field has been doing relatively recently. And this is some data that's gathered from pottery in kilns. When bricks cool down after they've been made, they lock in information about the direction of the Earth's magnetic field, and so you can use the bricks in kilns or pottery that's still in the kilns, and you can tell what the field did. That's called archaeomagnetism. And here's time in years before present. Here's zero, here's 1,000 years ago, here's 2,000 years ago, about the time of Christ, 3,000 years ago, about the time of David and Solomon. Now, the field strength had been violently moving up and down until that time, but about that time it settled down and the last major loop started decaying, and then the field strength at the Earth's surface started leveling off, and then it started decreasing, and sometime around 1,000 years ago it resumed this classical form for the decay, and it has been actually measured over the last 150 years. And that data is more accurate than the archaeomagnetic data, and here's what that recent data looks like. The strength of the field is decaying very rapidly. And here's the strength. It's measured in Gauss, because the first guy to measure these fields of the Earth was named Carl Friedrich Gauss. And there's Gute Deutsche Name. Ah, jawohl. Okay. So the unit that has been adopted to measure the strength of the field is called the Gauss. And he measured this back in the 1830s, and the strength of the field at the Earth's equator was then roughly 0.33 Gauss. And now at the Earth's equator, it's about 0.305, something like that. And in between, it's been measured periodically every few decades or so by many scientists in a worldwide collaboration and averaged out so that you get a good measurement. And you see that it's been roughly steadily decaying. Now, there are some bounces there, and that's because the Earth's field, the Earth's core, has some motion in it still. And so it's not a complete, simple decay, but overall, it's a nice decay. And the half-life of that is 1,420 years. Now, that's the strength that has that half-life. Now, what about the energy? Well, the energy of the field is decaying twice as fast as the strength of the field. Here's the total energy, and the number is in trillions of megajoules. Now, a megajoule is about the amount of energy you get when you ignite a stick of dynamite, or the amount of energy you get from a good jelly donut or something. You have something like that? The reason you don't blow up is you get that energy over a long period of time instead of in fractions of a second. Okay. Very good comment. You blow up like this. Those who eat donuts become shaped like them. So, when Gauss measured the field, you can take his data and calculate the total energy in the field, and it's roughly 30 trillion megajoules. And today, the field is closer to 25 trillion megajoules, and that corresponds to a half-life of 710 years. That's 720 is a mistake. 710 years, and that means the field is losing about 14% of its energy every century. Now, that's what happened to energy recently. What about in the past? Remember some of these earlier pictures. During the reversals and fluctuations, the field's energy decayed even faster than that 14% per year, because these fluctuations and reversals chewed up energy faster than the normal decay would. They're inefficient processes. That's why the evolutionist doesn't use this particular mechanism to explain reversals, because it doesn't maintain the field for them. It chews up the field. And so they've never looked at that particular mechanism. So it decreased even faster in the past during this period. So what that means is that today's decrease is as slow as it has ever been. It's either been as slow as now or a little bit faster than now. So we can use that fact to estimate the age of the field. And here comes a graph. Beware. But the alternative is equations, and that's worse. So. Now, the horizontal line is what we get from my theory of the origin of the Earth's
field. Remember my figure of 72 times the field strength today? That corresponds to this energy. That's the horizontal line labeled maximum energy up at the top. Over to the right, the solid part of the sloping line that's labeled actual is the data that you just saw, the decay of the energy measured in the last 160 years. Now, my theory tells us that the energy decay has always been at least that fast. So at other times, the true line would have been even steeper. So if we extrapolate today's energy back into the past, we'll get an upper limit for the age of the field, and that turns out to be 8,700 years. Now, that's the maximum age. What might the true age be? Now we get to the fifth part, my conclusion. We get to this part that says the true age could be 6,000 years. This is the same graph you just saw with some more lines on it. Now the solid line is a likely scenario with the field losing about 90% of its energy suddenly during a flood. Now when the flood was happening, the field was being rapidly reversed, and so that was chewing up a lot of energy. And afterward, during the fluctuation, the field was losing its energy faster than today. So you see that the biblical age of 6,000 years is quite plausible, but the age would not have to be any greater than 8,700 years. So this age is based on all the data we have on the field, as interpreted by the results of my theory. My theory of origins is not so critical, because we can set a similar maximum energy from very general physical considerations, as Dr. Barnes has. But it does depend on the theory's results about the rates of energy decay. So what can we conclude? And now we get to my conclusion. We have a maximum age very close to the biblical age of the Earth, but it does depend on my theory, which could be questioned, as all theories can. So what other theoretical explanation do we have for the Earth's magnetic field? Only the evolutionary dynamo theory. And how good are they? Well, this view graph says that the creationist theory is better than the evolutionary theory. If we're going to choose between theories, it looks like, to my admittedly biased eye, as if the clear winner is the creationist theory, because here you see the two theories, how they compare, creation and evolution. And first of all, creation gives numerical results. It's a numerical theory. And the evolutionary dynamo theory does not give solid numerical results. So it's better to have a theory that gives solid numbers, and then you can check it. And secondly, the creation theory matches the present decay numerically. Evolution theory can live with it, but it doesn't predict the number or the rate of decay that we actually see. And then the third thing is the fast reversals. The creation theory predicts fast reversals, and we found those fast reversals after I predicted them. And the evolutionary theory was caught flat-footed. It did not predict those at all. And fourthly, the solar system creation theory has done very well in the magnetic fields as found in the solar system, even to the point of making several predictions before the measurements were made. Evolution theory, on the other hand, has done very poorly in the solar system. So it looks like the clear winner is the creationist theory. So here's the bottom line of this talk. The Earth's magnetic field strongly supports Scripture. We talked about the origin from water, and we talked about the rapid reversals during the flood and the present decay. And all of these things tie in very well with biblical events and the biblical timescale.